Good morning. On this Labor Day, Unite Here Local 5 is putting the spotlight on affordable housing. The organization's IKEA movement is sponsoring a housing fair. We'll talk with Eric Gill later this hour. And when you think of sexual diversity and human rights, Cuba may not readily spring to mind. Visiting doctor and openly gay man Dr. Alberto Roque is working to change that. He'll join us in just a few minutes. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. A group of concerned Kama'aina is gathering to promote community management of marine resources on Maui. We'll hear from Ikolu Lindsay about the Polonui Hiu Community Managed Marine Area Initiative. And she's been called the godmother of surf art. We'll talk with Heather Brown about her sources of inspiration.
That's the conversation for Monday, September 7th. Now the news. Good morning, and thank you for spending part of your Labor Day with us. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Welcome to the conversation. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. So life inside Cuba has been really closed off to us for decades, yeah?
But with more openness comes more opportunities to peek in and find out what we thought might have been true as opposed to what really is true.
Exactly.
We're going to talk a little bit about that this morning. Now, with diplomatic relations reestablished with Cuba, Americans are learning more of the nuanced details of daily life. Part of those changes include the advancement of the human rights of sexually diverse people. One person responsible for the shifting attitudes is internal medicine specialist Dr. Alberto Roque. He's visiting Honolulu this week to speak with the LGBT community. He's in our studio this morning. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
How would you characterize Cuba these days in terms of its acceptance of people who are sexually diverse?
My opinion, what it's happening is that we have a more tolerant society towards sexual diversity and gender expressions in Cuba. People awareness about homophobia and the bad impact that homophobia has is increasing in Cuba, absolutely. But still we have a lot of challenges. This is a very slow process of changing people's mind. I identified in the last probably 15 years a shift, as I said, on these issues in the Cuban society.
A shift based on the understanding of what HIV/AIDS was all about and trying to work toward prevention, or just a general shift in attitudes?
Both. But mainly, HIV was the origin of this strategy. It was from the healthcare system, the first time that the state promoting policies, were implementing policies towards vulnerable groups that, like men who had sex with men. And although this is part of the sexual behavior, it's not related necessarily to an identity or to a sexual orientation issue or gender identity as such. It's part of this process, how everything began in a very positive way. And now the policies are better. For example, in Cuba, it was today's Labor Day. Actually, a law on labor was passed in 2013, recognizing sexual orientation as a source of discrimination, among others. They recognized, for example, that instead of saying that you were discriminated because of your sex, it was also because of your gender. So this is the first time ever that in the history of a nation we have a law protecting specific needs based on sexual orientation. And this is an expression that many things officially are changing. At the same time, the cultural changes are taking place in Cuba in a positive way.
How are those changes coming to be? Is this because there's a concerted movement, or you have pockets of people who are working toward changes?
In the first place, the We have a center that is run by the state. It belongs to the Ministry of Health. That is the National Center for Sex Education in Cuba. They started working on these issues many years ago, and now you have the results. We have like an awareness campaign that is called The Day Against Homophobia. There is a whole celebration during the month, mainly in May, on speaking, debating on the media in public spaces with a lot of cultural and academic activities in the whole country speaking about homophobia. This has been a very important issue. It started celebrating in 2008. So this is one of the issues, but also at the same time, a lot of activists has been taking part of this participatory approach, empowering this population, having a political approach on these issues of discriminations in general, and mainly focusing on gender identity and sexual orientation grounds.
Are they as segmented as it seems coming from just certain sectors? I mean, you mentioned about men and the idea of discrimination. I mean, these are different pockets, but looking at something that would be an umbrella organization or an umbrella movement toward all discrimination, all gender identities being recognized. I know you don't like the term LGBT, but as we have seen that movement develop in the United States, working in concert with each other in different parts of it, do you see that happening at all, or at least the beginnings of that in Cuba now?
It's the beginning. It's very incipient. Still, it's very divided into these labels or categories. And it could be important to identify the main characteristics or demands of a specific groups. But we are so heterogeneous, so diverse, and within the groups, even the groups, that in my opinion, we should articulate a movement with similar objective, similar goals, and at the same time recognizing specific demands in certain groups. For example, as a gay man, for me, it's not an issue of gender identity. Probably, but it's very important for trans people and the access to the guarantee of all legal issues concerning their transition to any other gender. So this is something that is part of some groups, the same as, for example, lesbians and reproductive rights. They should have access and the guarantee for certain rights that women probably do not need, although women also have reproductive rights to be recognized yet. So this is part of the issue that we can integrate, and not only based on sexual orientation and gender identity, but also racial issues and other sorts of discriminations.
Which sort of gets to the next part of what I wanted to ask you in terms of finding commonality that moves all those issues forward, or at least gives them a platform to be heard.
Yeah, I think so. And in my opinion, in the future to come is that most of the people, we're going to have a very integrated movement, and mainly from civil society in Cuba, united these efforts to what the CENESEX is doing, the National Center for Sex Education is doing, and we can empower a lot of population and mainly go into the community. That is, in my opinion, one of the main important issues to have a social and a cultural change. You can have many good laws, very revolutionary laws, but if you don't have a cultural change, it's useless.
And what about the relationship of what's happening within Cuba to what's happening globally and even within the United States?
Yeah, I mean, mainly from the United States, the exchanges that we've had, in my opinion, has been in international setting at the UN system with certain groups that are working together, articulated from the International Lesbian and Gay Association. This is an umbrella organization worldwide that started working on human rights since 1978. And is recognized by the UN system. And this is the way we've been exchanging with some activists from the US. I've come to this country three times, and I never had time enough to have exchanges on concerning specific exchanges on these issues. There are people coming from the States to Cuba, some organizations, religious groups that are gay, lesbian, but it's a way of, I think it should be increased in a way, the same as we do with a lot of Latin American countries, just to enrich both goals and works.
And it seems you'll be very much a part of that process. Thank you so much for coming
in
today.
You're welcome.
Dr. Alberto Roque is an internal medicine specialist. He's also assistant professor and adjunct researcher at the Medical University of Havana. He founded the LGBT group Humanity for Diversity, based at the National Center for Sex Education, also in Havana. He is lecturing in Honolulu this week.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:16. Coming up, promoting local control of marine resources before it's too late. But first, your quiz.
In today's Labor Day Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about the year a dock workers' dispute changed the course of Hawaii history and established the labor movement in Hawaii as a force to be reckoned with. The issue was wages. Hawaii longshoremen at the time were making less than their mainland counterparts, $1.40 an hour instead of $1.82 for loading and unloading the same cargo. Employers offered a 12-cent an hour increase, but it was rejected. When arbitration failed, 5,000 dock workers went on strike for 177 days. The labor action closed off shipments of goods to the islands, but workers agreed to unload military cargo, food, medical supplies, perishables, and mail. The opponents were the International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, or ILWU, and the big five companies that dominated business in Hawaii: Alexander and Baldwin, American Factors, Castle and Cook, Seabrewer, and Theo H. Davies. The dispute was tainted with allegations of communist influence on Hawaii's labor movement, an accusation that was often leveled at the movement in the post-war years of what came to be known as the Red Scare. It's the year of this historic strike that we're looking for this morning, and we'll be back with it in half hour. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Good morning, I'm Annie Camilla from Mango Season. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
There's a vast ocean out there, but its resources are not infinite, although the modern world has acted as if they were. Coastal ecosystems throughout the world have felt the disastrous impact of overfishing and general overuse, and there's a movement in Maui to bring about community control of local ocean resources. Ikolo Lindsay is asking concerned kama'aina to work with him to promote pono fishing practices and fish population recovery. He's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Ikolo.
Good morning, Chris.
There's a lot of work to be done, right?
Yeah, we got tons of things to do.
What do you think are the first tasks to be attempted?
The first task for us here in Honolulu and Lahaina is to really educate and keep the public aware of the many challenges that we face in the ocean and see what we can do. So education and that awareness pieces of the puzzle are the first part. And the second part of that And the hardest thing is to get people to change behavior patterns.
Yeah. Well, the mindset that brought about the behavior patterns is pretty well locked in, has been for a while, yeah?
Yes, and that's the toughest thing. You know, we've been doing this for about 5 years now, and I found that creating that awareness and educating the public and the community about what's happening here, and people are understand, but to get them to take that extra step of, say, not walking on the corals, or, you know, not throwing stuff in the sides of the sidewalks and the gutters that comes right out here, mm-hmm. is a little more challenging. And I found that working with the kids has been the most positive. The most impact has been with the kids, because the kids take home these messages and share with their parents. Now, yeah. as parents, we need to be good role models for our children. So now, when, you know, their kids come home and say, wow, you know, this is the channel for the place that we love to play, and this is what's happening with all the rubbish that's coming out of the storm drain. So now we can no longer throw things or soap or anything down the storm drains. And you know, other fishing practices are really challenged as well, how much you take, when you take, and those kinds of issues come up. And the kids are a wonderful way to protect our future as well as share it with the present.
Well, just in terms of trash ending up in the storm drains, kids aren't shy about saying to mom and dad, hey, what are you going to do with that plastic bag? You know, don't just throw it away, right?
Yeah. And you know, try to get them to pick it up before it gets to the ocean. So now our beach has been pretty clean, except for the cigarette butts. Not much anymore. We still find a lot of trash. So something's working here, and it's hard to measure how it's being done, but it's working so far.
So at least there's some movement on not just on the consciousness, but on the consciousness and behavior
yes.
realm, right?
Yes.
Well, then you have the whole issue of fishing practices and how they're regulated. And Ecolo, I get the feeling that coastal management is just too big a job for government, or at least government seems to be underfunded and are undermanned to take it on. Is that an accurate perception?
I believe that is pretty accurate and right on. And, you know, communities, and there's a huge statewide movement in many communities to take control of their kuleana, the area that they normally fish and play in, and manage those resources effectively. And I think a co-management position with the state is the best way to go.
Co-management. So what would be the state's end in this? What would be their role in this partnership?
I think a good example is the people, the community in Haena, in Kauai.
Uh-huh.
You know, they've really studied their resources, they've worked with the state, and they have achieved a community-based subsistence fishing area designation and rules package. So what that's done is it allows the community to come up with additional rules for their designated area and also additional take limits and gear restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
And having the community not have police powers, but to sign it and inform everybody about this is what's expected, this is your rules of conduct, code of conduct,
mm-hmm.
this is how much you can take, and this is why. And they've worked really hard with the community. You know, this it's called CBSFA. It's been on the books, their rules, for 20 years now, and this is the first one that's actually been signed by the governor. So it's really exciting, because there are a lot of other communities behind them wanting to do the same thing, like Uncle McCoy is coming up next on Molokai, and Ka'upulehu on the Big Island is coming up. Kipohulu in Hana is coming up, and so are we. And this community movement is, to me, the most effective way to manage your resources, because the community understands the resources, they use it. You can't blanket a rule for the whole state and expect it to work and underfund the divisions that are expected to maintain these resources.
But a local community can kind of, if not police itself in terms of enforcement, they can at least police itself in terms of stating what its own set of standards should be. Yeah,
Correct. And you know, it really comes down to police, to policing yourself individually. We all have this penal code of conduct in what we take, when we take it. Pay attention to spawning seasons and cycles, and just take what we need to eat for today. Then I think the resources will come back. You know, it's a very challenging thing to do, especially when you use a free resource for economic gain to support. You know, I know people got to live, and if they don't have jobs, they can use fishing to pay the bills. Or a bucket, a 5-gallon bucket of opihi that will go for $500, $600, $700. It's a great way to support yourself in any endeavor.
Yeah.
But by taking it all now, we're just not leaving anything for tomorrow.
But that's such a fundamental human problem, isn't it, Ikolu?
Yeah, and that spans many different, you know, realms.
Sure does.
You know, greed, economic opportunity, rather than doing the right thing because that's the way my grandparents taught me how. And,
well,
you know, also being multicultural here, especially in Lahaina, we're being very open to many cultures and many different styles of fishing practices. You know, what works in Micronesia, it doesn't work here in Lahaina because their resources are different.
You know, in a way, Ikolu, and I'm afraid we got to run, but it really is circling back to the way things used to be in so many ways. And I wish you luck with this. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, and you know, it reminds me of this Olelo no Eau, Ikova Mamu Kova Mahope, which states that the future can be found in the wisdom of the past.
That's a really good, that's a good one. Thank you, Ikolu.
Thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
Ikolu Lindsay is a coordinator of the Polanuihiu Community Managed Marine Area. They meet the first Saturday of the month, and you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
President Obama may have enough votes for the Iran deal, but one of our closest allies remains staunchly opposed.
It's not so much the particular of the deals. It's the idea that Iran has threatened to wipe Israel off the map, that it denies the Holocaust.
A psychological portrait of Israel as the U.S. and Iran begin a thaw. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
We wake you up in the morning, we're with you on the commute, both ways and weekends too, and you can count on us in times of emergency. These listeners know the value of the true friend they have in Hawaii Public Radio, and we gratefully acknowledge Thomasine Ka'ana'ana Lindsay of Haula, Michelle Chang-hun of Waianae, and Leah Fukuyama of Honolulu. Member support keeps HPR in business. Please call us at 955-8821, weekdays 9 to 5, or you can donate online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, protecting and managing Oahu's drinking water resources. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University. Named a top 50 Best for Vets business school by Military Times for graduate programs designed to fit the lives of veterans and military professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, robotic surgery means a lot fewer incisions, yeah?
Well, that's what we're going to talk about today. You know, in some cases, robotic surgery has been shown to have shorter recovery time, smaller incisions, and actual better outcomes. So we're going to talk to an expert today about what's it like to perform this type of surgery and what sort of results does he see in the real world.
You're actually, is the robotic surgeon actually sort of looking through a window at the machine operating or looking at a video screen?
And actually, you could do robotic surgery if you had a console from your office, not even in the operating room, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. But there's actual robotic surgeries being done here on Oahu, and we're going to talk about what surgeries are this being done for and how does the machine actually operate.
So you could actually do it. It's almost done remotely, I mean, as long as you can see that screen, huh?
As long as you can see the screen, technically, you could do it remotely, which has wide ranges of applications, particularly when you think about doing surgery in other countries. But, you know, we're going to talk about the basics. What's it like? Because as remote as we get now is maybe you're 10 feet away. So how does that work? And then how could this in the future be done so that surgery can be brought to places where maybe there's no qualified surgeon for certain activities?
Well, it could really open things up. It cuts down on the bedside manner quite a bit.
Literally cuts down. You got it.
Exactly. Thanks, Kathy. And that's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozek tonight at 5.
Hawaii's relationship with labor unions has been entering a new chapter in recent years. The Unite Here Local 5 IKEA movement has sought to energize political involvement among its members in a variety of issues. Later today, the group is sponsoring an interfaith housing fair to engage different groups on Labor Day with organizations and community leaders around issues of affordable housing. Unite Here Financial Secretary and Treasurer Eric Gill is on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Hi, I had to get off mute. Good morning.
Okay, good. We had just a moment of pause there, wondering if you were on the other end of the phone. But I'm glad you are, and thank you for the time this morning. What do you see as being the role of labor in the housing debate now?
Well, I can speak for our union. Our members work really hard to build a future for their families, and many of them, most of them, come from other countries to do that. And so having a house and a place to plant the family and a place to create a future for the kids and the grandkids, that's central to what, you know, our members want in life. And so housing is something that we have to take into account, and it's something that the union has to advocate if we're going to, defend and promote the quality of life for our members.
When you talk about, you know, having workers who have worked for a long time and that this is all very important to them to be able to settle family and to be able to have a life, we've heard a lot of that rhetoric for a very long time, but it hasn't really resulted in true, you know, expansion of affordable housing. What's it going to take?
Well, it's going to take a change in the political will of our government leaders. The government has ignored this problem, and while allowing things to happen that make it worse and worse, you know, for example, you know, they seem to be permitting every development that is presented to them, and you know, just giving permits for high rises that are built for rich people, built for rich people's investment for second, third, fourth homes. That's what is being permitted to being built. And yet, nobody's building affordable housing. And meanwhile, we have laws to protect our neighborhood, zoning laws, and we have laws to protect our people and our neighbors from running illegal hotel operations. Those laws are being ignored and not enforced, and therefore, you know, hundreds and maybe thousands of units are being withdrawn from the rental market and put into the vacation rental market, in essence, being transferred for the use of visitors as opposed to local people. And this is forcing our housing prices up, both for the fee simple costs as well as the rentals, and putting our people on the street. And it's not a surprise that we have an increasing homeless problem.
There is a thought that accessory dwelling units might provide some relief. Do you see that as being a viable option?
Well, you know, accessory dwelling units are a way that people will build housing. No developers building affordable housing, but presumably people might build housing in their, you know, in their backyards for their kids. That's not going to work, however, if that housing is then turned straight into a vacation rental, which only will make the problem worse and will insert illegal hotels into our neighborhoods and disrupt our quality of life. But in regards to the housing, we'll not address the affordable housing problem, but we'll just add to the problem. So if we're going to do this, then we have to make sure that those units are, in fact, built for our families and our kids, as opposed to being turned into illegal hotels.
Whenever we talk about affordable housing, and as we have for many, many years, there's always the sense of, well, we have to make sure more will be built. We have to make sure this, we have to make sure that. But there's a real gap period where you have people who are unable to find housing at that very moment. Is there anything that you see short term that isn't being done that should be?
Well, certainly, you know, I mean, we have developers. Right now, Oahu is kind of the center of a huge amount of capital rushing in. And the reason for that, of course, is from the investor's point of view. If you're an investor in Japan or some other place, you know, the stock market is iffy. It's at record highs, can only go down. Bonds aren't making any money. So, you know, so investors want to be able to park their money somewhere, and Oahu real estate is a good place to do it. So you got all this money flowing in, and millions of dollars being spent, billions of dollars being spent on investment, and yet the government hasn't captured, you know, virtually any of that to help actually build housing for people that live here. And that's the basic problem with the cost structure of the housing, of construction costs and everything so high. For a developer to build affordable housing, you know, depending how you define it, but if you're going to build housing that's actually accessible to the majority of people, then you have to have some way to subsidize that housing or reduce the cost of it. And they're not capturing the money from where it's flowing to be able to transfer over to the place that will help us.
Meanwhile, you have a lot of people who are still looking to find housing. Today, with the housing fair, what do you hope that will be accomplished when you have different organizations and you know, different community leaders cross-pollinating and trying to create a greater movement toward affordable housing?
Yeah, well, in Hawaii is one of the places where we have a huge amount of problems in housing. We have very high housing costs, and we don't have bridges across the river like in New York or San Francisco where we can go and live in a cheaper area and still get to work. So we're stuck on an island. And so what needs to be done is Hawaii's people need to get organized to be able to apply political influence and pressure on our leaders. Right now, they're just listening to the people with the money who are slapping money around, but they're not listening to the needs of the people. So we hope to get housing organizations and individuals and people who are interested in this issue organized so that we can be more effective as a political force.
And how do you see that political force developing?
Well, basically, this particular issue, you know, first we're saying, you know, here we have all these things that need to be done. We need to find a way to find the money to subsidize and to encourage and promote affordable housing to be developed so our kids have a place to live. But first we have to ensure that we don't get worse. Let's stop the bleeding. Let's start enforcing the laws that are there to protect our neighborhoods, and let's put a real disincentive to landlords taking their units out of the local people's rental inventory and putting it into vacation rentals. The laws are already on the books. They don't have to be written. They just need to be defended and applied and we need the political will of the leaders to do that. So we need people to take this serious and vote accordingly. When people vote, when politicians know that people are going to vote a certain way, that's the way they go.
I wish we had more time to talk, but thanks very much for being here with us this morning on Labor Day.
Well, thank you, Beth Ann. Once again, it's always a pleasure.
Eric Gill is a financial secretary treasurer for Unite Here Local 5. Later today, the Interfaith Housing Fair happens from 4 to 7:30 at the Sheraton Waikiki Lanai Ballroom.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a year in Hawaii history that was dominated by a labor dispute. For 177 days, 5,000 dock workers in the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, ILWU, paralyzed shipping to and from the islands by going on strike. Only essential goods were allowed through, and tensions ran high as the strike dragged on. A columnist in the Daily Paper tried to link the ILWU to an international communist conspiracy. A group of influential women known as the Broom Brigade circulated leaflets listing the names of suspected communists in the ILWU. In July of the year we're thinking of this morning, industry owners created Hawaii Stevedore Limited, HSL, which hired non-union workers for the docks. That inflamed tensions even further until the territorial government stepped in by enacting the Dock Seizure Act in August, effectively taking over control of the dock. It wasn't until October 23, 1949, that a settlement was reached, and that's the year we were asking you about, 1949. It's 8:45, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from REC Solar, a commercial contractor that designs, installs, finances, and maintains commercial solar PV systems throughout the state. More at recsolar.com.
Time for Stargazer, our weekly look at what's happening in the universe around our tiny planet and some of the things that we can look for in our evening skies. We turn, as usual, to Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, for this week's report. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, Stargazers, Saturn is still visible to the right of the constellation of Scorpius, which is sort of to the south. It will set in the west at around about 10:47 p.m. Now, our moon will be a thin, waning crescent this week, bringing excellent conditions for stargazing to our island skies.
Now, we have a very exciting story this week about one of the facilities on the top of the Mauna Kea summit going green.
That's right. This week, we visit the Gemini Observatory atop Mauna Kea, where the folks at Gemini are putting starlight to good use. That starlight comes from our sun, and Gemini is using its limitless energy to provide power for the observatory.
And before we find out more, Christopher, is this the only place that's using solar power up there?
Right now it is, yes.
Wow.
So as you mentioned, Gemini has been the first on the mountain to install a photovoltaic system, or solar panels to you and me.
I gotta believe from that vantage point, those things can get quite a bit of juice.
Yeah, this array will be able to generate around 10% of the total power required to operate the facility. The panels themselves will be 70% more productive than those you can find at sea level.
So tell us about this exciting construction up on the Mauna Kea summit.
Well, as you can imagine, construction up there is incredibly challenging, and not only because of the threat of altitude sickness, but the weather this year, as you know, hasn't exactly been typical for Hawaii.
And on a serious note, though, it does seem like it's a cool thing to have observatories which are looking out into space actually powered by one of the phenomena out there.
That's right. There is a beauty in it for sure. It's easy to forget that the sun is a star. You know, to most people, it's just a bright disk of light that makes their day at the beach really nice. But we forget that it's an enormous nuclear fusion reactor producing incredible amounts of energy every second. We are very fortunate to live on a planet that's close enough to take advantage of all that free energy.
And if you just laid solar panels around the whole summit area, would it be enough to power everybody up there?
That's a good question, actually.
Well, that'll be one for a future stargazer. Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, thank you very much for the report.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
The ocean has never been far away for surf artist Heather Brown. She worked as a boat captain and a dive master to put herself through her Bachelor of Fine Arts program at the University of Hawaii, and her work to this day reflects an open-air, sunlit perspective. She prefers media that many others overlook, media she refers to as lost arts, and she's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Do you ever venture inland? I picture you spending all your time kind of at the edge of the land where land and sea meet.
Oh, I do. I love nature everywhere around the world. I'm constantly drawn to it, and it inspires me. And, of course, the ocean is my favorite place to be, and so that usually is what I paint most. But I appreciate all forms of nature, yes.
One of the things that I see in your work is just it's different just because of the choice of media that you've made, yeah?
Yeah. I kind of take my perspective of Hawaii and remove all the things that I don't want to see and keep everything that I love, you know, like kind of take out buildings, cars, people sometimes, or maybe just have a couple people and just focus on the natural beauty, the trees, the flowers, the sand, the water, the mountains, the sky.
And all these elements are kind of fit well with the whole design notion that you've put in, but I'm looking now at something called a Gicle print.
Oh, yes, that's a canvas reproduction. They're limited edition. And that way it makes it so that, you know, I paint one original, but I kind of like the idea of not just one person having that one piece of art. You know, maybe many people can enjoy the same piece of art.
So a Gicle is just a way of reproducing, like a it's a form of a reproduction, yeah?
Yes, yes. It's museum quality. It's archival, and it looks pretty much identical to the original. It's basically the only way I could tell is looking at the paint strokes. But as far as the color, the saturation, it's the closest possible you can get.
When you say that you prefer lost arts in terms of your media, what are some of those?
Goes back to my love for printmaking. I feel that a lot of art now is produced digitally or on the computer or by machines, and I really love the idea of a handmade piece of art. You know, if it's either me painting something or carving into a wood block and then inking it up and running it to the press and pulling the print off with my hands, there's something really special about that, and I think it is something lost. And I like to remind people, you know, like, this is how art used to be made, and it can still be made that way. And I'm lucky enough that I was able to go to University of Hawaii and learn those techniques, and I still practice them today.
You using the sun to actually burn the images into a screen, how does that work?
Oh, yeah, it's a photosensitive chemical that you, it's kind of like a emulsion, and you coat a screen with it in the dark. You let it dry, and then you bring it out in the sun, sometimes only for 30 seconds. But whatever you put that's opaque on it is going to make that area wash out when I hose off that screen, and that's going to allow ink to pass through onto the paper. It's a really fascinating process, and it's a little bit of science involved with art. And
it sounds like you convert a section of cloth or canvas into like photographic paper.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of paper you would print an image on in the days when people had dark rooms. Yeah.
Yeah. It's more though on the screen. The chemical is actually put onto the screen, and that is where basically my template is to print on paper. So I use usually like a cotton fiber paper to print on. But all the magic happens from what I do to the screen and the chemicals I apply to it, rinse it out, and then using that screen to make multiple prints later.
Is this, you know, there's some types of art that I'm thinking of where there's a little bit of a random factor in what you actually get when you throw a pot or something like that. Is there a lot of that in your techniques, or do you have a pretty clear idea of how things are going to result.
Always, always. I like to call them happy accidents. And it happens with all kinds of art that I do, from painting to printmaking. And you kind of have an idea of what it's going to look like when you start, and hardly ever does it come exactly like that. But little surprises happen where you don't plan them, but you're so excited they happen. And it's kind of the surprise factor that I enjoy about printmaking. And
so that's something to be embraced, not something to be afraid of.
Of course, of course. And I encourage that to other people that like to make art. Sometimes they get frustrated and that they can't create what they're thinking. But I just say, let it go. Let whatever your hand is going to do on the paper or whatever you're working with, let it happen.
Have you had much opportunity to do some teaching of your techniques?
Oh, you know, when I was going to UH, I was helping teach art classes at the Honolulu Academy of Art, which was really fun. I felt like I was one of the kids in those classrooms with them, and I was usually making projects with them. But since then, I have a fear of talking in front of people, so I get so nervous. So usually now I don't teach. I mostly concentrate on creating. But
well, you can't tell, Heather, as far as your reticence. It's not it's not coming through at all. It's good to talk to you about this. And I'm looking now at some of the prints that you've made on wood, and the wood seems to give it a sort of a, I don't know, the images are less sharp-edged on a sanded wood surface, yeah?
Yeah, and the ink is somewhat transparent, so you can mm-hmm. kind of see this faint wood grain behind the light colors of the wood that give it this character that is so beautiful, and it's
and once again, you have
really
an opportunity for happy accidents when the grain of the wood kind of works with what you're painting, I would think.
Yeah, sometimes there's a little knot in the wood, and it'll happen in the sky, and it looks like a little sun or a moon, or sometimes, yeah, darker grain patterns happen and change the colors, and each piece, even though you have the same image, each one will be unique because of the wood background, and that's what I love. It's almost like nature is affecting my art. And
well, I'm sure it is, Heather, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us this morning. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on the show. And
sure.
It's good to talk to you.
Heather Brown, surf artist, will be at the Honolulu Zoo for an event called Keiki in the Kitchen, Food, Fitness, and Fun. That's on September 12th, and you can learn more about her and her work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. It bears repeating, Beth Ann, this would be a very different country without the labor movement, and it was really changed the life in America permanently and forever.
And you wonder, though, how many people understand what that was all about, as opposed to, let's go to the sale at insert the store of your choice, or have a barbecue.
Well, you know, the birth of the modern labor movement has a lot of very adversarial history. We talked about the 1949 dock strike in Hawaii, but modern Hawaii was very much formed by the added strength in the post-war era of its labor unions.
And now it seems that labor is also looking to redefine itself in a modern context, and as we talked about today, using the issue of affordable housing, which we've talked about and talked about and talked about, but will there be a catalyst for political will to make some serious changes more immediately than not?
Well, we're certainly, the affordable housing issue is not going to go away.
No, but people might, and
yeah.
that's the other issue.
That's it.
Anyway, we are going to say goodbye to you for this morning, and we'll be back with you tomorrow. We're going to be talking about Molokai community is requesting an extension for its planning process, at least to be able to respond to it. We'll be talking with the Community Plan Advisory Committee Chair, Stephen Chukin.
And singer Shari Lynn pays tribute to one of her original sources of inspiration.
We like to hear from you, and you can get to us anytime you like on our talkback line. The number is 808-792-8217, or if you like email, you can send us your thoughts to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you like social media, we're there too on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR. That's me.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more information about guests and topics are there too. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of the conversation. Have a good day.